Grant me justice against my adversary. For some time he refused, but finally he said to himself, even though I don't fear God or care what people think, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice so that she won't eventually come and attack me. And the Lord said, listen to what unjust judge says. And will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry out to him day and night? Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will see that they get justice and quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?
This courtroom parable has two protagonists, a plaintiff and a judge. The NIV titles the parable after the plaintiff, The Parable of the Persistent Widow, following Luke's opening line, which identifies the purpose of the story. Jesus told his disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and not give up. Yet, the parable colors in the judge while it merely sketches the widow. While the widow speaks a single short sentence, the judge's line runs long enough to be a paragraph. When the parable ends, the widow is held up as a model to emulate, and the judge is the actor from whom we learn a lesson about God. Perhaps the two characters equally deserve our attention. The judge is introduced first, described as one who neither feared God nor cared what people thought. Both attitudes are with respect to the office of a judge. The thought that he was accountable to God didn't keep him up at night. Neither did the thought, what will people say, trouble him during the day as he went about misusing his privileges. The widow, meanwhile, is at the receiving end of this corrupt practice. She has no access to her deceased husband's estate that has passed on to his male heirs, whether sons or brothers. She is at the mercy of an adversary against whom she is certain the law can protect her. Perhaps this third party, the adversary, owes her money or property, which he is refusing to let her have. Whatever the case, it appears that she has a legitimate grievance. Perhaps the judge is expecting to be bribed to take action, and the widow has none to give him. Perhaps the defendant in the case is a powerful man, and the judge would rather favor him than this widow, who counts for nothing in society. Whatever the details of the case, we understand that the judge is the widow's only hope. Her life is in his hands. So she persistently presents her case before him, pleading for his attention. Eventually, he gives in, but hardly because he cares about dispensing justice. He gives in because he is tired of being nagged. The New Living Translation renders it like this. This woman is driving me crazy. I'm going to see that she gets justice because she is wearing me out with her constant requests. There you have the picture of one who couldn't care two hoots for justice, and of one whose every thought, day and night, is directed at justice, the judge and the widow. If even a judge so indifferent can act in favor of a plaintiff, how much more God will act in favor of those who have none to act on their behalf. Abraham was certain of such a God, was he not? Will not the judge of all the earth do right? He asserted. Indeed, Abraham had good experience of the justice of God. So let's travel back to a story in Genesis that gives us a picture of God as judge. It might help us better appreciate our Lucan parable. So, Genesis 16. When our story begins in Genesis 16, a decade has passed since Abraham and Sarah have emigrated to Canaan. Over this decade, at least thrice, God has promised Abraham that he will birth a great nation, his descendants as innumerable as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. But 10 years have passed, and by now, Sarah is persuaded that she cannot conceive. So she falls upon an alternative. 16:1. Now Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abraham, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go, sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abraham agreed to what Sarah said. So after Abraham had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarah, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. While it appears that Sarah's faith has reached as far as it can go, it is possible that she is falling back on her legal obligations to Abraham. We know that in ancient West Asia, prenuptial contracts required that a barren wife would make arrangements for the husband to have children born to him. This arrangement was through surrogacy. The surrogate would usually be a slave woman who became a wife only in that she has intercourse with the man. The son born of the union belonged to the mistress and her husband and was the legal heir. The son would be the legal heir, but not the son of the surrogate. We might recall that Rachel took a similar initiative, and Leah picked up the practice, even though she had four sons already. Perhaps Sarah is acting from her understanding that God works through human agents. In a culture that believed that conception was divinely facilitated, Sarah is removing herself from being an obstacle and hopes that God will grant the child promised to Abraham through her Egyptian slave. Abraham, like Jacob later, agrees to the plan, and the slave conceives. This is how we first meet Hagar. She is introduced as a member of the household of faith, but we cannot help noticing the liminality of that membership. She is Egyptian, she is a slave, and she is a woman. Introduced into the story against the fact of Sarah's continued barrenness, she is less a person and more a solution to a long-standing problem. In the conversations that follow between Sarah and Abraham, she is nameless and a possession. My slave, your slave. We understand that Hagar is a wife only in function and not in status. She will build a family for Sarah, but can never be what Sarah is. A little like the widow in Luke's parable, she inhabits the margins. The trouble starts when Hagar begins to behave like a wife. 16:4. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. And then Sarah said to Abraham, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." Your slave is in your hands, Abraham said. Do with her whatever you think best. Then Sarah mistreated Hagar, so Hagar fled from her. In a culture in which fertility is desirable in a woman, Hagar treats Sarah lightly, as a fertile woman would a barren co-wife. In a later period in history, you will remember that Penina gets away with provoking the barren Hannah year after year, till Hannah, red-eyed with weeping, plunges into deep anguish. However, in contrast to Penina, Hagar has no immunity. A South Indian proverb describes such a situation like this. Whether the leaf falls on a thorn or the thorn falls on the leaf, is it not the leaf that is damaged? Hagar is the leaf that should have remained aware of her vulnerability. We understand now how completely evacuated of privilege is her position as Abraham's wife. Hagar understands it too when she sees that Abraham absolves himself of any obligation towards her and when Sarah turns on her. And so when the mistreatment becomes intolerable, Hagar runs away. Runaway slaves were common in the ancient world, so common that there was legislation on them, even in the Mosaic law. This runaway slave catches our attention because she is pregnant, and because her southerly route suggests that she has set herself the impossible mission of running away to Egypt. Egypt, which lies on the other side of a desert, because it is the only place she knows as home. Even in her pregnant condition, she considers the perils of the wilderness tolerable to her condition in the home of God's chosen family. How ironic that the Egyptian is first oppressed by Abraham and Sarah, in the same way that Egypt will later oppress, the verb is the same in the Hebrew, in the same way that Egypt will later oppress Abraham's descendants. God's people should do better than this, should they not? Just as the judge in the Lucan parable should have done better than he did. And this is where God steps in. The one whom, in a later story, Abraham will address as the judge of all the earth, the one who will certainly do what is right. 16:7. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, Hagar, slave of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going? I'm running away from my mistress Sarah, she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. The angel of the Lord meets her at Shur, a border town, at the point where she will leave inhabited lands behind her and head out into the barren wilderness. The angel of the Lord is the usual Old Testament reference to an angelic messenger. When he speaks, it is as if the Lord himself speaks. When he opens conversation with her, we recall that neither Abraham nor Sarah have addressed her by name in this account. She is just the slave or the servant. But notice how God calls her by name. When not even Abraham gave Hagar a chance to explain herself, God does. This is the judge of all the earth. As often, God opens with a question, letting the other party have the first say. And from Hagar's statement of the problem, God extracts a solution. Hagar must return. Is this fair on the part of the judge of all the earth? Perhaps God sees Abraham's home as the safest place for her at this point, pregnant as she is. What is more, God doesn't send her back without giving her the means to endure the difficult situation at the other end of the return. The past cannot be changed, but the present can become bearable if Hagar can glimpse her future. So while Hagar's mind is concentrated on the past, God addresses her future. 16:10, the angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous for you to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." In words that remind us of the promises to Abraham, God gives Hagar a glimpse of a people group that will descend from her son to be born. The ill that Sarah willed for Hagar has somersaulted into a blessing. The prediction that Ishmael will be a wild donkey of a man need not be read in a negative sense. In Job 39:5-8, the same beast is celebrated for its freedom. Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? I gave it the wasteland as its home, the salt flats as its habitat. It does not hear a driver's shout. It ranges the hills for its pasture and searches for any green thing. Like such a beast, and in stark contrast to his mother's present bondage, Hagar's son will rejoice in his freedom. That he will live in hostility towards all his brothers is a common feature of nomadic tribes, and promises that the child will grow into a chieftain. Where Hagar suffered beneath the hand of Sarah, the angel promises that Ishmael's hand will be against his brothers in independence. While Hagar had to flee before her mistress, Ishmael will eventually dwell before his brothers. No wonder then that Hagar accepts this future gratefully as a gift from God. She sees in this oracle the sympathy of God. She sees divine compensation for human ill-treatment. 16:13. She gave this name to the God who spoke to her. "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have seen the one who sees me." That is why the well was called Be'er Lachairoi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abraham a son, and Abraham gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. For the first time in the canon of the Bible, a human being has met an angelic messenger bringing word from the Lord. What is more, Hagar becomes the first person in the Old Testament to give God a name. That name, born out of her experience of God, declares that God is one who sees. The name given to the boy reiterates her experience of God, for Ishmael, like Samuel, means God hears. The Lord sees and hears the distress caused to this Egyptian by Abraham and Sarah, just as he will later see and hear the distress Egypt causes Abraham's descendants. God does not play at favorites, but he does align himself on the side of the one who suffers injustice, even if, perhaps especially if, the perpetrator of injustice is the family chosen to bring blessing to all the peoples of the earth. The judge of all the earth does what is right. So, when the story reaches a resting point here, we see that God has resolved the crisis precipitated by an arrogant maid, a harsh mistress, and an irresponsible master. His plan has widened in scope to accommodate the fallout of Sarah's misplanning. That he has widened his scope becomes incontestably apparent in the chapter that follows, Genesis 17. When we come to Genesis 17, 14 years have passed. Abraham's family now has two sons, Hagar's Ishmael and Sarah's Isaac. In between the stories of their birth is the account of the covenant of circumcision, established as the identification of the unique relationship between the Lord and Abraham and Abraham's descendants. Thrice in this account, in Genesis 17, we are told that Abraham circumcised his son Ishmael. In fact, Abraham and his son Ishmael were both circumcised on that very day, 17, 23, and 25. One Old Testament scholar sees in this how Ishmael represents an expansion of election beyond the boundaries of Israel, and as such, Ishmael models the proselyte who undergoes circumcision. The judge of all the earth condescends to do what is right by Ishmael, even though he is the product of a plan God has nothing to do with, even though he is non-elect. The promise will continue through Isaac, but God will honor the fact that Ishmael too is Abraham's offspring. But of course, we know that the story is not ended just yet. There is one more movement to the tale, one that requires the judge to step in one last time. We turn now to the next Hagar incident recorded in Genesis 21. Among Hindu families in South India, the first time an infant is fed solid food is an event. Friends and relatives are invited to witness the child being fed its first morsel of well-mashed rice. Perhaps originating from the days when infant mortality was high, the family celebrates that the child has now survived the vulnerable years. A similar motivation may lie behind the great feast that Abraham holds on the day of Isaac's weaning, when the mother ceases to nurse him. If weaning usually happens at age 2 or so, then at this point in time, Abraham's older son is about 16 years old. 21:8. The child Isaac grew and was weaned, and on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham was mocking. And she said to Abraham, "Get rid of that woman's son, for that woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac." The conflict now is not so much between Sarah and Hagar as before, but largely concerns Abraham's two sons. Despite the divine initiative to embrace Ishmael, Sarah tosses aside Ishmael's right to belong. Circumcised or not, he is to her the son of that slave woman, and as such, is easily stripped of his birthright and quickly disqualified from being at least one of Abraham's heirs. She sees Ishmael threatening Isaac's position as the legitimate heir. The outsider is immediately shown his place, literally outside the household. What does the judge of all the earth think about this? A careful reader will find it hard to miss that Genesis 21, the expulsion of Hagar, and Genesis 22, the binding of Isaac on Mount Moriah run like two parallel panels of tapestried story. In both, Abraham receives communication from God, apparently at night, because in both cases, the action begins early the next morning. Abraham speechlessly makes provisions for the journey, for Hagar, food and water. For himself, in the next story, he loads the donkey with wood. Hagar heads towards Egypt via the desert of Beersheba. A mother and son are in the wilderness, just as father and son will be by themselves climbing up into the wild mountains of Moriah. If Hagar lays Ishmael under a bush, Abraham lays on Isaac's back a bundle of wood. Hagar sits down resigned to her belief that Ishmael will die. Abraham moves forward in the trust that Isaac will somehow survive. Hagar sobs, while Abraham speaks in faith that God will provide. God provides for both the boys. The angel of God halts Ishmael's death cries, while the same angel of the Lord intervenes to save the unresisting Isaac. Both references are to the same being, a divine messenger. The angel calls Hagar by name, just as he will call Abraham by name. Both Ishmael and Isaac are guaranteed a blessing, each to his own measure. Both Hagar and Abraham see alternatives by which to save their sons' lives. God shows Hagar a well that she has not noticed so far. Abraham, similarly, sees a ram for the sacrifice. Just as Ishmael receives a life-giving drink, Isaac is literally released from death. Ishmael receives the promise that he will become a great nation. Isaac receives the promise that his descendants will be as numerous as the sand and the stars. What is more, we are told that God was with Ishmael as he grew up. Abraham had long renounced his responsibility as father, but God took charge as his guardian. He learned the skills he needed to survive the harsh desert life, and in anticipation of the nation that he would become, the story in Genesis 21 ends by telling us that his mother found him a wife from her people, just as Abraham will do for Isaac in the years to come. God does not own Abraham's expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael. Rather, by compensating for it, he neutralizes it. This reading of the Hagar story might come as a surprise. Often, our reading of the Hagar story is colored, perhaps, by the terrible realities of the world in which we live. But the world, as we know it, we should remember, began to take shape long after the story of Hagar and Ishmael, as recorded in Genesis. And we can't but conclude that these stories in Genesis show us a God who acts on behalf of those who have nowhere to go and no one to go to for wrongs to be righted. This is the God that the Lucan parable holds up as our hope. Will not God bring about justice? The evangelist asks at the end of the story. If God could include an Egyptian female slave into the ambit of his jurisprudence, surely he cares that his chosen ones, you and I, should not go unattended. Perhaps, like the widow, we are at the receiving end of injustice. If we, like the widow, cried out to him day and night, would he keep putting us off? No, Luke says. He will act quickly to see that we get justice. The parable not only brings comfort to those of us in situations of injustice, but it also challenges us to be like the judge of all the earth. It challenges us to step into situations that need our intervention. It challenges us to be God's agents of justice, however small or great the opportunity. It challenges us to keep our eyes and hearts open to the Hagar here, the poor widow there, those who have nowhere to go and no one to go to for wrongs to be righted. So in conclusion, here is our response to the parable of the widow and the judge. We are ever grateful that the judge of all the earth will act on our behalf. And at the same time, we are sobered by the demand that we must act on behalf of the judge of all the earth. Shall we pray? O judge of all the earth, we wait with longing for the day when you will come to establish your reign on this bewildered and bleeding world. You will bring justice. You will bring lasting equity and peace. Till then, keep us from giving up hope and give us the daring to act on behalf of those who are giving up hope. In Jesus' name, amen.